Laird Hamilton and Gabby Reese are two legends in their own right. But what's interesting to me is the lessons that they've each learned from radically different fields. For Gabby, it was the field of competition and modeling. For Laird, it's pitting himself against the ocean. And the spiritual meaning and the growth that comes from encountering that which is ultimately, undeniably, and inexorably real. So I'm excited to share this incredibly real conversation with Gabby Reese and Laird Hamilton.
Before we get started, a word from our sponsors. First up, we have Bond Charge. Now, unless you've been living under a rock, you probably understand the benefits of sauna and red light therapy. But not all of us are able to acquire a red light sauna and put it in our garage or put it in our house. So one of the technologies that can be used is a sauna blanket, and Bond Charge makes the best version of these sauna blankets that I've ever encountered. So instead of having to go into a sauna, you get the heat and the red light therapy in blanket form. So you can make a little nest, you can put on your Bond Charge sauna blanket and start to experience the benefits of the heat and the sweat and the red light therapy. So this is an incredible solution to get into one of these restorative practices that is really necessary for our fast-paced lifestyle, a lifestyle that requires us dropping into these deeper healing modalities. So I really encourage you guys to check out all of Bond Charge's products, but especially the sauna blanket. So if you go to bondcharge.com, bondcharge.com/amp, you can use the coupon code AMP to save 15%. That's bondcharge.com/amp, coupon code AMP to save 15%, which equates to $140 off your very own sauna blanket. Check it out. And if you're still on the fence, recognize that Bond Charge ships worldwide, has an easy return and exchange policy, a 12-month warranty, and all of their red light devices come in small, portable options. It's a great solution. So check it out, bondcharge.com/amp.
Next up, we have Apollo Neuro. Now, Apollo is a stress relief wearable that is designed to help you become a calmer, more mindful version of yourself through touch therapy. And it does this by providing these warm, pulsing sensations that actually go through the device. And it's really interesting to feel the effects that this has on your nervous system. It's something that Vailana and I will use both when we're in a medicine journey or a meditation or sometimes a breathwork experience. But honestly, it doesn't have to be during any of those experiences. The effects of the Apollo wearable will be noticeable whether you're actually paying attention to it or not, or whether you're in one of those transformational or transcendental states or not. Some of the results of the clinical trials that they've done on Apollo Neuro have shown that users experience 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety, 19% more time in deep sleep, up to 25% increases in focus and concentration. And all of these different effects are based on different programs and different pulses that the Apollo Neuro actually pushes through in the vibrational mechanism of the device itself. Just like our brainwaves pulse at different frequencies, that allows us to actually access different states of consciousness. This is working in not exactly the same way, but it's working in a similar way, pushing out different frequencies of pulses that are sensed by the skin and received by the nervous system. It's a really cool device developed by neuroscientists and doctors. You may have heard Dr. Dave Rabin talk about it on my podcast already. So if you're interested, go to apolloneuro.com/Aubrey. That's apolloneuro.com/Aubrey. And you will get $40 off of the wearable. Laird and Gabby.
Hi.
Hi. Well, we've had a very stimulating conversation prior to this podcast, the pre-podcast podcast. But now I want to drop into this podcast with you guys because we're facing a time of extreme stress and turmoil.
And one of the training grounds for stress in turmoil is found in sport and activities. And you guys are legends, icons in these different arenas of competition, which applies the pressure that allows you to learn something about yourself, to know yourself when things get hard, or the wild nature of the waves. And so I really want to enter this by talking about the adaptability and resilience that you guys have developed through your own craft and how that might apply to the bigger world that we're facing. What internal characteristics and strengths that you guys have developed that can help guide yourselves and your family and those you love, you know, through this, what seems to be a very turbulent period that we're heading into. The waves are going to get choppy.
They seem very choppy already.
Yeah, they're already choppy. They're already choppy and chaotic and surprising. Yeah. And it's an ocean out there that we really don't know how. We don't have a lot of data on it because there's a lot of storms brewing that are different than the storms we've ever seen before.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you actually made me cry earlier, but I think for me, it's having a sensitivity that people have already so many things on their plate. Like what Laird and I and you get to do is a real luxury. The fact that we can train or do sport or follow a passion. Yes, you take risks and yes, maybe you're hardwired for it, but it's also a real luxury. Mm-hmm. I think to follow that and to have that opportunity to put yourself in those environments. And so I always am almost more sensitive or concerned for the people that they never get that space to go through those. What does Billie Jean say? To feel pressure is a privilege. Mm. And
one to have
and,
those tools.
And but it's also with that privilege comes a responsibility.
Yes.
And the responsibility is I've had this privilege. And so now let me take the strength that I've gained from this privilege and use it to serve and share and lead and help, you know, guide. So yeah, we've all been in a position of privilege by the amount of pressure we've been able to, you know, take on.
Yeah.
And then now, all right, what are we going to do with it, right? And so I definitely want to go deeper, like deeper into the layers for mm-hmm. each of you guys to talk about because they're slightly different, you know, although you've certainly been in plenty of competitions, but it's different than a volleyball competition.
Well, and, he's in like surviving nature because, you know,
yeah,
Laird's
exactly.
never really competed. I think he did one and was like, oh, these guys are going to tell me what there is on my art. And so I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. So it's
well, I mean, I've raced before too. I mean,
oh yeah, that's true.
I've raced paddle boards, I've raced windsurfers. I mean, I've done competitions, but
this way, we're actually so different.
Yeah. And that's perfect because that allows each of you to bring the unique lessons of that. And I know that you guys have brought that into your union and into your own, you know, kind of understanding of everything. But now if we go individually first and then bring it together into a shared harmony and then bring it to universality, how people can actually take these lessons that you've learned, find the ways to access them in their own life, because there's always ways to go out. If you're willing to, you can find pressure. You can find something that's really cold and you can put yourself in it. You know, you find something that's really hot and you can put yourself in it. You know, you can find something competitive at the YMCA. I'm sure you can, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different ways that you can access this, but you have to have the will to do it. But to have the will to do it, you have to understand that it's not just about the thing itself. It's about training characteristics that can help, you know, help you navigate through these challenging times and are helping us navigate through these times.
And choosing too. I mean, I think that better to choose it yourself than otherwise it'll be chosen for you. And I think Jordan says that. He goes, choose your sacrifice. So better to induce it so you at least get to choose what you're inducing. Better to go, hey, I'm going to go cold. I'm going to go hot. I'm going to hike to this, you know, for 3 days into the night and mm-hmm. or whatever you want to do, but choose it. And otherwise it's going to be chosen for you. And it might be something that—
And you're not going to be ready because you've never trained.
That's right.
You've never trained.
That's right.
Maybe we can start for you, because his teacher is so different. Mother Nature is such an interesting teacher, and for a spirit like Laird, which has a, in a way, not only a lot more defiant in a certain way than I am, but also more artistic. I was sort of more linear in the ways that am I wise. And I think Laird had this passion from artistry, and also had a much more serious teacher.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, with permission, of the goddess, we're gonna go in deep here, Laird. Yeah. We're gonna go in deep, and I want to start this by let's say, like, you know, if you really actually just tap into your, you know, mystic consciousness and your heart center consciousness, and you think about the ocean. Like, think about the ocean. Like, what's your relationship with the ocean? How would you describe the ocean?
I mean, I think that if you could just think about every different kind of relationship that you have, friend, you're the son of a man, you're the son of a daughter, you're a husband, just all those relationships, every different kind of relationship that you could have with people, it would be all of that together, like all of that in probably the most all-encompassing, you know, something that you love, something you're scared of, something that, you know, that can nurture, like save you, and something that can kill you. And just, I mean, it just has all those characteristics about it. It's that you become, like, you gives you, for me, I just feel like I just was gravitated towards it as, I mean, why do we just sit and look at the ocean? Like, what is it about it that draws us to it? Everybody, like, why is beachfront property more valuable than any other kind of property? Because it's like, because you're near it, right? You're near that. I say something crazy, but I talk about, you know, man's always trying to mimic nature. Like, when man's always just trying to copy, like, oh, nature flies, nature swims, like all this stuff. Like, we have an immunity and we can fight disease. Man's always just mimicking everything in nature. And I go, and man's been building a cloud, right? Like, we're building this cloud, and all the information, we're putting all the information in the cloud. And I go, well, where's nature's cloud?
God.
And then, well, the ocean.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the ocean is the biggest form of God,
yeah, sure.
Right? It's God. If you look at our creation, where we are, and you say God is creation, well, the biggest, most, I would think the deepest, the biggest volume, just everything, it would be the ocean, right? So that's where the cloud is. Like, the cloud of God's cloud is the ocean.
Yeah.
All that's ever existed, all the information is in that environment. But
it's an interface with something that's real, that's true, that's honest.
Amen.
And it sets the parameters, because if you don't have interaction with something that's real, true, and honest, if you're in the digital nuosphere of some metaverse somewhere, it may not be honest. It may be manipulated. It may be something that's been enculturated or something that's been kind of adjusted to try and feed you something. But the ocean is just the ocean. It's real. It's true. It's honest. It's God's ocean. You know,
well, even like a relationship with people. I mean, now all these digital domains are just variation of the best and the worst of people. But even people, I think I gravitated towards the ocean because of what you said, because it's honest and truthful and reliable. Like, it's the most reliable thing. You go there and you can rely on it. Like, you can rely on that, its behavior, what it's going to do. And it doesn't matter, once you understand some of its characteristics, you can go anywhere there is an ocean and understand the characteristics. Just because it's not the ocean, you know, you can, because it's still the ocean. And so in a way, a wave comes a certain direction. If you're under, there's no air. It's just like, there's just all these things about it that you can rely on. And I think in a world of unreliable people, even family, people that raise you, the lack of reliability that you had, that to have that as a place to go to, like a sanctuary, like a place to that you could go and then have it be a teacher. Mm. So now you have this place that you can go to that's your teacher, but it's also super honest and
come
reliable.
To the classroom of God.
Yes.
It's called the ocean.
Yeah, welcome.
Welcome to the class. Welcome
well,
to
nature,
school.
Ultimately, right?
Yeah, nature, all of nature.
Nature, all of
but
nature.
But the thing like about the ocean, it just interfaces with you. It's wet. It's liquid.
Yeah.
It's moving.
It's what you are.
It's what. Yeah, yeah. It's really a part of us.
Yeah.
And so there is something unique about you, though, because you took the scariest part of this wild, unknown nature. I think people are scared of nature because of the unknown and because of the scary things that could happen. The big waves. Oh, shit. The big waves. And you said, no. I want to go there. I want to like know that part of the wild. I want to know that part of God. I want to see if I can adapt and be able to navigate through the fear and find the ecstasy in the wave that's coming. And this is a very good metaphor. If there's a huge wave coming, we're about to all be big wave surfers in this world, right? And so either you're like, well, I'm going to be fucking the Laird Hamilton of this big wave that's coming, and I'm going to strap in and I'm going to learn how to ride this motherfucker. You know, and you had that kind of instinct and drive, and that's unique. That's a part of your unique self signature. It must have been just like a part of who you are, or did it develop? What was that thing that caused you to say like, "Oh, that scary thing, I'm going to go there."
Well, I think I was born with a draw, like a draw to it, like just a draw to scary things. Like you know, you see kids and there's 10 kids and one kid just always wants to go and jump off something or do something that's a little, you're like, hey, you know what, Joey, you might die if you fall the wrong way, you know? So I'd say I probably had that piece. I had one of those. My stepdad always says, you know, big wave riders are born and not made. You don't, you know, you just, if you have some of the elements and then you get exposed to the environment, I think that helps it. I think the drawn to that fear, because you are scared, that you want to know it that you have a relationship, and then the fear of it becomes, less. It just
master
becomes,
your fears it, or let fear be it, your master.
That's it. So go and be and know it, and then it doesn't. I mean, like, fear of the unknown is the scariest, right? It's like what we don't know, we fear. Once we know, it gets less scary. Like, hey, you're scared of sharks? Well, go hang out with some sharks and go where sharks are. Pretty soon, you're like, yeah, sharks are cool. Like, I'm not really that scared of them. But when you don't know how a shark is and what a shark is. I mean, our ability to paint pictures in our mind of what it could be is amazing. I mean, it's part of why we have what we have on the earth, is because we can make this stuff up in our brains. But that's the same thing that can just imprison us. I think you can be imprisoned by that. And I think that's part of my wanting to get set free. I wanted to set my free from that prison of being scared, because I was scared on land. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to go to the scariest thing I know. I mean, I know I liked heights always too. I think heights were a big piece of my thing because of the decisiveness of it. You know, like you're falling or you're not. It's high or it's not. Like, it's real clear. Like, you get there, you look over, you're like, that's
real
far down there. Yeah. Like, will I live if I land wrong? And can I, you know, all that mindset, and then the willing, and then that ability to that commitment of go or don't go, but there's no in between.
Mm-hmm.
There's no kind of going. You don't kind of catch a wave. You don't kind of jump off a cliff. You either jump or you don't. You either catch a wave or you don't. And so we talk about—
And it's
about,
very dangerous if you actually try to—
That would be the worst.
Do it a little bit.
Hesitation?
Yeah.
It's over. Because then you're going to kind of fall down the rocks on the cliff, or you're going to kind of get smashed by the giant wave. So in a way, I think that's a piece. I think that decisiveness too, real clear, like that gives us, for me, I feel like it gave me a sense of I wouldn't say stability, but a sense like something to hold on to in a universe that's spinning.
It's right? almost like I want to say like the safety of courage.
Yeah.
Right? Like the safety yeah. of courage.
Yeah.
Because the only way you're safe is if you have a lot of courage.
Yeah.
You know, and then courage means moving forward in the face of your fear and not retracting. You know, yeah. fear is a contractive yeah. force. So like yeah. the safety of courage of yeah. like, yeah. if I'm courageous, we're going to be safe.
Yeah.
And that's true in so many situations. Again, bringing this back to the universal, like there's only going to be safety if we have courage. You know, if we have courage to speak our truth, if we have courage to stand for what we believe, if we have courage to, you know, face the storms and the waves that are coming and say like, no, I'm getting on my board and I'm going to surf this thing and I'm not afraid of it and I'm going to keep going. Yeah. Like that may be the only way that we're going to be able to make it through.
But I'll add to that, at least I feel like we have to do that. It's funny because everyone is interested in strength. You know, people, they've always loved like force and strength. And I think what I see though is I think we have to do that, but not from, because that fear makes us reactive or angry or and scared and all, you know, acting out in those ways. It's like to face it, but in that kind of very concise and quiet and loving mm-hmm. place. Because we're sometimes, I think, taught to face everything, but with, and I have to be careful of this, like Laird is really good at being confrontational and loving simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be confrontational. I've had to learn how to be confrontational, not from fear and use anger,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's like reminding people too that when we're facing this collectively, is how do we do that in a place that we're not so scared not, that we're well, not
a
loving.
A non-contracted place. Yeah. And that's well, also part of the courage.
In stillness yeah. too, right?
Yes.
How do we do it in stillness? And there's a form of submission
yeah.
in courage, right?
Uh-huh.
Like the ability to just be okay to be okay. Like I can just be and not, I don't need to, that the biggest move may be just the ability to not react in a way that you'll have to react for the reaction. Like that's right. the thing. It's like, you know, I have
it's
a saying.
Choosing the waves that you're going to ride.
Exactly.
Are you going to ride this
yeah.
emotional wave or
yeah.
no?
Exactly.
Are you going to ride or no?
Well, yeah. I use like a parable about the guy standing on a paddleboard and he's standing there and he's balancing and then a boat drives by and there's a big wake and he sees the wake coming and he starts to freak out because he thinks the wake's going to hit him and he starts getting all unstable. Then the wake hits him and knocks him off. Had he just stood there and then waited till the wave hit him and then absorbed the wake, he wouldn't have fallen.
Yeah.
But he's reacting to what hasn't
right.
happened yet. And so I think there's some pieces in there about being still. There's some, I can say personally, I know that one of the reasons why I'm still here with us and in the planet is because I've submitted at times and through submission, I was able to survive.
Tell me one of those stories.
Just being held down by a giant wave.
Tell me like a specific story about that. And then like if there was a moment where
well,
this.
I was riding a board that I was attached to. So I had this board that had a big metal fin on it, a big like a thing that a foil on the thing, a big fin. And I was attached to the board with boots, like snowboard boots. And so I was mounted to the board. So it was a little bit like having an anchor on your foot.
Yeah.
And I was surfing in a remote place with a friend of mine. It was just him and I, and we were a mile or a couple miles offshore, like a mile and a half offshore. And I caught a giant wave and got caught behind. I wasn't going fast enough and I got caught by it and I got pushed down into the dark. And I was at the bottom of the, like in the darkness, mounted to an anchor, like a mm-hmm. sea anchor. And I was there and I had for a second, I went to like, you know, try to fight to the top. Like I was going to, and I just, I re kind of calibrated and got still and was like, okay, well, I'm not going to get to the surface with this anchor on before I need to breathe. And the only way I'm going to make it is if I just take my time to get myself in a position where I can get myself out of these unattached from the boots.
Yep.
And at which point the boots, I won't be able to swim because I'm wearing boots. So I'm going to have to just use my arms. And I just went real methodically through the procedure of getting myself and I made it back to the surface and enough time that I didn't need to, you know, breathe water. And my friend was there and he was kind of freaking out because I hadn't come up for a while. But it was just that stillness, that calibration of, okay, really thinking about where I am and what I need to do and not just reacting, not just like, hey, if I just get to the top, mm-hmm. you know, and so I think that lack of panic, comes from being in those situations over years and years and having time when you've been held under and been at the mercy of, you know, I describe it like wrestling somebody who's just a lot stronger and has you. You don't try to get out of the hold when you feel the pressure, but as soon as you feel unweighting or unlifting, you make a move. And so again, it's that being able to be okay in that moment, being okay to be still when all this stuff's happening around you and not react in that in some urgency, right? And that's hard to do. That's something that actually takes some time to
got to train it.
Train it.
Gabby, it strikes me that, you know, being married to Laird and he's the father of your children, this has got to give you a bit of confidence that if the world comes and throws some shit at your family, mm-hmm. like Laird's not going to crack. You know, like if the pressure comes, like you know this man and you know who he is at the core of cores, because he knows who he is at the core of cores, right? Like that's the thing. Like you may know somebody, but if they don't know themselves, you don't know them, you know, because you can only know what they know.
Yeah.
You know, and you can maybe see what they can't see, but you don't really know what, you know. So you probably have a really high degree of confidence in your man.
I met Laird at 25 and it was complicated and nothing about it on paper was easy. Laird had a 4-month-old daughter and was in a complicated relationship. And I'm what we would call in the world a kind of a sensible person. I was working and I wasn't really looking. But when I met Laird, I thought, oh, this is different. And I remember maybe I was married to Laird for a few years, maybe 3 or 4 years. And I was at an event, which I never go to. And do you remember Carson Daly?
Yeah.
Okay. So he walked up to me and he's like, oh, it's so cool. You're married to Laird Hamilton. And I said, yeah, because if everything goes wrong, I know that I'll eat. And I just said it like that. And I didn't, I mean, I grew up on an island and in a way my needs are pretty simple. Like I'm not distracted by like, oh, shiny things. I'm a pretty like shelter, food, love, community, purpose. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not distracted by stuff. And I think intuitively I knew that about Laird. And then obviously over the years, not only in the ocean, but even personally being in compressed situations with Laird. Because actually Laird day to day is harder than Laird when the shit hits the fan.
No, I feel you, bro.
Because it's like a wild animal.
I feel you.
No, I get it. You know what I mean?
Because the pressure brings out, evokes, it calls forth the best of us.
Well, none of this makes sense. La, 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 we are on a flight, we have a dinner at 6. None of that makes sense to Laird. But like, oh, this, we have something to deal with? That makes sense to Laird. And so it's funny because there are many days where I'm like, this guy is a lot. Because he's always intense. Which I love because that's the other thing people have to remember. People go, oh, it should be a little of this and that. Life is never a little of this and that. Life is this or this. So it's like, where do you want to be? You want the guy on the couch who's like, yeah, huh? What? Did you say something? Or do you want the guy who's like this and super intense and sort of restless and I need something, but there's nothing that anybody can give me because mm-hmm. it's like, I have to wait for the ocean. You know, it's not like we can help him.
Right.
But behind all that in my mind, I go, yeah, all this means nothing. But when it comes down to it, that person always does the right thing and is the right person, which is either to help you or to protect me or to, you know, be there for a person or make the good decision. And I'm like, at the end of the day,
you trust him.
Yeah. And what do I care? Okay. You're restless, you know? And Laird said to me one time, and it really was true. I walked in and he was in the shower and I looked at him and he could tell from my eyes and he goes, "You think it's tough to live with?" He's like, "Try being like this." And I thought, you know what? I love you. You know,
yeah.
And his daughters, they get it. They know him. They see it. And my 19-year-old who's in Israel right now was like, she goes to me, "Do you know that dad, I've never heard dad say anything negative about you." And so as they get older, they're starting to really cherish these qualities about their dad that maybe was like, "Whoa, what's his deal? You know, he's just so intense." And like, "What are you eating? Are you eating that? Oh, you're eating a tater," you know, it's just like, and they're always like, "Oh my gosh," you know. But yes, it's the trust. And it's sort of at the end of the day, when we focus on things, it's like, what really matters?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's enter your portal of competition, because one of the things that I really like to think about is there's what I call sacred competition. It's honest competition. It's real. Like when you're out there and you're playing volleyball, it's real. They're fucking trying to beat you.
Yeah.
They are trying their hardest. It's real. It's authentic. It's honest. They are giving you their honest best. And that's the beauty of competition. Like a wave, it's honest.
Mm-hmm.
It's honest. The players are trying their best to win within the construct of the game, but they're trying their best to win. Sometimes they might try to cheat, but let's not talk about that.
But like, they're still trying to win, even if they're cheating.
But like, still, they're trying. But exactly. You even understand it there. Yeah. You're like, you're trying to win. I get it. You
know, really badly.
You're just cheating.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, there's an honesty to it. And so that's something beautiful. It's real. It's divine, I would say. And that's why I call it sacred. And then there's the comparison competition, which is like, "Oh, that person looks like this. Well, I want to compete. And that's like what I think is the shadow of competition. And I think someone for you is, you know, as a woman, being able to go so deep into the realness of competition. What I'm interested in is, yes, I want to talk about like that force, meeting that force and that honesty, but also like how it's related to the shadow aspects of competition, because for you, competition, you understand it, you get it. Yeah. So I would imagine and anticipate that the shadow competition doesn't have as much a hold on you.
Well,
vicious competitor. Let me just sidebar.
Sure.
Vicious.
I'm sure.
Vicious.
But I'm not competitive in all things. Like if we're going to go to the door, I wouldn't be like, "I'm first." You know, like I don't care.
No,
I'm not one of those
people. And it's a
defined
game.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, it's not through the door, but every game that was ever made.
No, and I never.
I can't wait to hear you
say like, "Oh, I was right," or any of that. I think there's a couple elements to that, which is the appropriate place,
because
I'm more interested in my life than like I won. You know, I don't want to be around those people. But competition did a couple things for me. It was just really the platform. So volleyball gave me a family. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up with that much stability. And also because I was 6'3 at 15, it sort of gave me a really obvious tribe.
Yeah.
Right. It was like, people would say to me like, "Oh, do you play basketball and volleyball?" "Yeah." "Oh, that's why you're so tall." "Yep. That's why I'm so tall." And it gave me this tribe. But what I also learned in that particular environment, there was two things that I really liked. And for me personally, as a person who played professionally, I only felt it a few times. You have these little perfect apex moments. There's so much precision. And again, when I'm talking about the real precision, it doesn't happen that often. That was really fun to experience. Like, oh, wow, I've practiced that so many times. There was one, you know?
Yeah.
But the other thing was I always really respected myself more as a person after practice. After working hard, after training hard, those environments made me feel good about me.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, oh, you have, because it's honest. I'm like, you can't phone this in. I simultaneously, when I went into college, I moved also part-time to New York and I was in fashion. So that juxtaposition was like, oh, this is a little bit like smoke and mirrors, phone it in. You look the part. And this was like, no, you got to earn this.
Yeah.
And I really liked who I was in that environment. And you get to know yourself, like you said at the top of this conversation. I got to know myself. Like, was I going to freak out? Would I be someone you'd want to go to war with? Because that's who I want to be. I want to be somebody that somebody be like, I can rely on that person, that they will not lose their wits about them when they just get their neck squeezed, you know? And so competition did that for me, and it taught me a lot about getting up after losing and being even humiliated and embarrassed and being like, you can survive that. Because in our minds, that, oh, that's one of the worst things that can happen. I'm humiliated in front of a bunch of people.
Sure.
And you survive another day. So there, it gives you room, because then that makes you braver.
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, well, I've failed so many times.
Publicly on TV.
I've failed so many times. This is it. I'll just stick my, like, let's go. Exactly. Business, relationships. I mean, relationships was even harder. Laird is the one who really taught me about courage, about loving, because I was definitely guarded there. And I remember we almost got divorced a few years into our marriage. And I remember thinking it was unfair that Laird always had his neck on the chopping block when it came to vulnerability and love. And he would look at me like, are you ready yet? Like, are you going to come down here? Cause it's all a risk, right? In that way.
Yeah.
And so that took me a few more years. I didn't learn that in sport, the emotional one.
Sure.
So it definitely helped then for those other things. And then the other part of comparison that you mentioned, it was very liberating, because whether it was fashion and working with literally girls that were so beautiful, when you would sit at lunch, you'd think, you know, they say you can't have it all, but I think this girl has it all. Like, it almost looks like someone I can't look at too much, because I might stare at her. She's so physically beautiful.
Right.
And then conversely, in sports, girls who could jump out of the gym were super strong, lean, ripped, athletic. So you just had badassery all around you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you learn to celebrate it.
Yeah.
And be like, you know what? Good for you.
Yeah.
You're a badass. And so that really is helpful.
And that takes you knowing yourself and knowing yourself like, oh, no, I know myself. And then my unique self is also badass. And so badass recognizes this badass in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's there's so many different aspects that you just mentioned in that little rant. But, you know, one I want to go back to is the work that you have to do to perform, to get that apex moment for both of you. You know, like, there's just reps and work and practice and training. And that's also something that, you know, for some people, we've gotten used to it, but without sports or without some activity you really care about, you don't get to practice that it takes work. Like, it takes work to build a company like On It, or, you know, like the superfood company that's thriving now for you. Like, it's work. Like, you gotta work. You gotta work for everything. And sports teach you how to work.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you bring this up, because one of the conversations that we have a lot about our three daughters is, where are they going to get that, you know? And the oldest one did it through education. The middle is gravitating more towards sport. And the younger one is just by nature, I feel like she's a grinder. She just has this grindy mentality.
Mm-hmm. You mean your clone?
A little bit.
That one? You mean that one? Bit, yeah. You wonder where she got that?
Okay. So I go, okay, so because I just want them to be able to, your point, we'll have athletes, for example, that come see us, and they were, let's say, really good in college and almost good enough to be pro, but got an injury. And we just always remind them, listen, loaded gun, you just have to pick your next target.
Yeah.
Like, you've figured that part out. But make it genuine. Wake up so that you're solving problems you want to be solving. Like, On It was something like, you're like, okay, I got to do this, but you were okay to solve those problems.
That's the problems I wanted to solve more than anything.
Yes.
That so time.
That part, like, I loved volleyball. Laird clearly, my relationship with volleyball is so completely different, and had a space where Laird's is a forever lifestyle relationship with the ocean. And I see that with mountain athletes and other, it's different when you're in the elements.
Well, Laird's relating to a being.
Yes.
The ocean is God. This is part of his spirituality. Like, this is
his church.
It's his church. Yeah, exactly. So it is different in that way. But, you know, I think there's a temple that you still hold inside your psyche, and it's the temple of competition. And Laird, you know, speaks to that in the competitive nature, that fire to compete. Oh, here's a game. Here's a defined game.
Yeah.
I want to, and within this game, there's not only do I want to win, but I want to talk a little shit too, because that's a part of the game. Like, that's a part of the fun of it. At least it is for me. You know, it's like, that's like a big part of this we're playing this game, so this allows me to be a little bit bad.
Oh, well,
I'm going to be bad.
I do say that that's one thing about sport, especially for women, is to allow yourself to be like a belligerent teenage boy. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like when I played ball, you had that. I always was more quiet though. Uh-huh. I wasn't a person who would talk smack. I mean, you'd have to push me really far.
You're just a quiet killer.
But totally, you were also getting some other pressure from outside. So that was making you were already getting, attention because you were doing this other work and you had a lot of stuff going on. So she was already a target. It was like, don't give them another excuse.
But I do say this about sport or even training hard. Like when we do pool training, in that moment, it's like, you're just a being. I'm not a woman. I'm not this age. You're just a the spirit that's expressing themselves this way.
Yeah.
And so that
level playing field.
Yeah.
Like there's nobody, like you don't get to bring any of your other stuff, all your accoutrement of yourself. And you're just a purse. You're an animal.
Yeah.
And you're an animal who can do a certain thing and you either can or you can't. You know, like you go up and you got a block and you got a hitter. Yeah. Like there's someone who's going to hit over it or around it or through it or whatever. Yeah. Or there's a blocker who's like, nope, not today. You know, like, and that's the truth.
Yeah. And I think that was the other thing too, is getting to express that side, because as we live longer in life, then we become sort of more things, if you will. Like now I'm someone's mom and someone's wife and I'm all... And in a way, it's like, no, I'm just a spirit living. And so that always gave me a good reminder about how to go back to that. And I know how to do it in my training still now. But sport really helped me with that.
Yeah.
Well, that was the foundation too. When you look at, if I think about what all the work and the discipline and the getting up from failure and all that stuff, when you just realize that really all of that was just to set the foundation for the real game, which is how long can you live with high quality life? How well can you survive a relationship and parenting? Like the real, like for me, I go, the real thing is like, I call it the victory through attrition, right? It's the guy that's standing on the top of the hill when no one's left, you just win. Like you just win because you're the last guy left. And so but if you look at it, you go, hey, what's the real contest? The real contest is, the whole thing, like the whole life,
the big game,
the whole life. And how, what life did you live? What was the quality of the thing? And at the end, when you're standing and you're like the last guy up there and you look around and you go, well, no one's here. You don't even have to be any good, right? You're just the only one left. And so, so if you look at the real, like when I think about her and her discipline for her training, for her work, for her family, for her, that's the real competition. Like the sport gave her the foundation to be able to know, have the work ethic, to be not discouraged when you get down to like all those values that you need. But the big game is this other one, which is called life. It's a tough one and we're in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so same thing to you. I imagine the fact that she's gone through the crucible of competition to that degree.
Yeah.
You trust Gabby. Like you really trust her. You trust her that if things come up, she's going to be able to handle it. She's going to be able to grind if she needs to grind. She's going to be able to adapt if she needs to adapt. If she's attacked, she can respond, not react. You know, like there's all of these things that you can trust about your wife. And so what I see here is just like a deep bond of trust that's between you guys. And I think as we enter these more challenging times. And I think relationships are really getting tested and challenged right now in a significant way. And it's about, can I trust you? Can I trust you if things get way harder? You know, and I think that's important. So you start looking at those relationships. It's not just your wife or your husband, but it's also those, that inner circle around you. And then that circle ripples out and is like, all right, how far does my field of trust go? Who can I really count on if things get gnarly? Mm-hmm. And because it can happen in a moment, you know, like you don't know when it might happen. You don't know what attack may come, you know, and
it takes a second.
It could just be like, here it is.
A second.
And then who's gonna rally? Who's gonna be there for you? And who's gonna like abandon ship?
I think what you're saying is interesting too, because you always love the word civil discord. I think it's a really just a perfect phrase within that, civil discord. And to your point, where we're coming through 3 years of a lot of people stopped being friends just because they had a difference of opinion. And so trust doesn't mean you agree with me and we do everything the same way. It just means I can hear you out. I can hear something that's different than I believe and still we can talk about it.
Yeah. Well, and then I can rely on you too, because you can, I mean, I've said it before in the ocean, it happens a lot. I go, yeah, I don't need you to like me. I'll still save you. Like, I'm like, no, I'm saying, like, I don't even care if you like me. Don't like me, but I'll still come and put my ass on the line and save you, because that's the person I want to be. I want to be the person that like, will do that. Whether I like you or not, I don't need to like you.
And what you're speaking to is goodness. And in our postmodern world, they're trying to erase goodness, but goodness is real. Goodness is the good, the true, the beautiful God. Good God, good God, good God. This is it. And now, of course, you can talk about the God that's everything that includes the bad, and you can get really confused with that. But we actually deep down know goodness. We know what goodness is. It lives in our heart.
It does.
And when we trust the goodness in the people around us, then if the mind is thinking different things, then you go in and then you kind of can look at those ideas. And if you trust that they're not so fragile, that if you penetrate some of their ideas, that they'll go like, oh shit, that idea was not good. You're right. Like, and you want somebody who's willing to do that, who doesn't have that ego and that facade, like, I can't be penetrated because I'm the intellectual and I'm the one who knows anything. And if you challenge my ideas, I say the pyramids were 3,000 years old. And Graham Hancock's like, nah, they're 12,000 years old. And you're like, I leave the room and storm off. Like, you can't trust that fucking guy. You know, storms off. He's got to be like, interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about this.
I wonder why we're so afraid.
Well, our identity, our identity is wrapped up. Our identity is wrapped up in our beliefs, you know? So you're a doctor or an immunologist or this thing, and then you put this thing out and you're a record and your identity. And then you're afraid that if this gets wrong, then people won't think you're smart at all. And your value proposition for your whole self is wrapped up in what you believe and what you've said. And so it gets really confusing when you're fused, when the self is fused to the like thinnest identity. Part of your identity, it's a fucking problem. The self has to be different. The self has to be in the heart. And then your identity is like, well, it is, it's evolving. It's always evolving. It's adaptive to the reality and the truth that comes about. Yeah. You know, we were talking about, you know, Bobby Kennedy before we got on the podcast, and I gave him like the most solemn oath I could ever give. I said, if you choose to run for president, I give you my word and I give you my sword. I'll do everything I can.
Why did you do that?
I did that not because I knew any of his stances on any policies. I understood a little bit of what he was saying about war and about glyphosate and about, you know, and I agreed with, you know, the kind of surface level, but I didn't really know him that well. But I was already all in because I felt his goodness. I trusted that no matter what, he was going to listen and not be offended. He was not going to be stubborn. He was going to take the information, the best information he can, and act honestly. Maybe he wouldn't act right when all the tallies were, you know, in, but he would act with honest intention. And I knew that about him. He's a good man. He's a good man. And goodness is real. Goodness is real. And I think that's what I look for when I'm like trying to align myself, is like the goodness and the will and the ability. Now, the ability to actually be in your goodness requires the type of training that you guys have been through, right? It's like, I think most people do intend to be good, but until they've trained themselves and actually know themselves in a deeper way, sometimes they're incapable of being good when the pressure hits. And this panic will arise. I mean, I'll tell a story about my father who, you know, I buried this year. And in this one moment, you know, he was not a great, like, comfortable scuba diver, you know? And I'm reticent to share this story because I love my father and he gave me so many gifts and he was such a beautiful man and all of that was true. But like I saw a moment of badness come out of my father and a moment of badness come out in a tough situation. So we were in Hawaii, we're doing the scuba certification. I was 13, getting PADI certified, right? And we were doing a exercise where you do the buddy breathing, right? So regulators go off on one person and then you regulate, like you breathe, buddy breathe back and forth. So you pass the regulator so
you have
back
one regulator,
two one regulator, two people down there, yeah. And so we were doing it and then he got, like you said, a moment of panic. I don't got enough air. And so right before I was able to take a breath, he grabbed the regulator back. And I got, and like, I was just calm and I swam underneath and grabbed my own regulator and started breathing it. And then, you know, the instructor ultimately talked to us about it. But that was a moment where like fear hit him. And he loved me so much. Like he loved me so much, but he hadn't trained himself and put himself in situations where if some challenge comes and he's threatened, that he knows how to respond. So that was in a way a part of his training. Now I was 13, so I didn't like coach him through like how this could impact his life in a positive way or something. But it was just simply that my father was a good man, but the pressure created a bad action, you know? And I say bad in just that it wasn't in the way that it could have been because fear had like seized him.
Yeah, fear is, you know, we train a lot of people in the pool. And, you know, they'll use the water to do all the military training. And a lot of guys get what's called aqua trauma because they want to see, right?
They actually just use the pool to break people. Yeah. Is why they use water specifically to break people.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the, probably there's, I always say five primal fears, right? Falling, burning, eaten by a big animal, drowning. I mean, we have some like deep primal fears. Yeah. And so water is very useful to bring out.
But we say without having to really mess with people, you can see in about 10 minutes. You'll know pretty quickly. You'll go, oh. And there'll be some people who really surprise you. They will not really have listened to what your directions were. They're down there. They've got the dumbbell. They haven't made the right choice. But you look in the eye and you're like, oh, they're still okay though. Mm. Like, and it could be some lady who doesn't look especially fit. Maybe she has a very strong mind. You know, maybe there's just people also different.
Comes out of, it doesn't always make sense who does well.
Yeah.
Like it's, I mean, sometimes it makes sense. You're like, oh yeah, you would expect they would and they do.
Yes.
But then sometimes there's like, you would expect they will and they don't.
They
and you're
don't.
Like, oh, okay. And sometimes it just surprises you. But yeah,
That's why I think with your community and with the people you love and trust, like you got to go through initiatory practices. You got to do the things that will allow you to
know
them. And competing with them is one way.
Yep.
Going through, you know, challenging external environmental situations. Yep. Like when I hiked Mount Śniżka with Wim Hof and a bunch of brothers without our shirts on in the sleeting Polish, you know, winter in January. It was fucking cold. And, you know, we had ice spikes on our shoes and it was gnarly. And so I'm climbing, scrambling up this fucking hill. The wind's blowing 70 miles an hour. We got a chain to keep us from falling off the other side. And one of my ice spikes slips off my shoe and goes down like 40 feet down, just like toboggans down the fucking hill. And I'm like, no fucking way. And I'm like, I have one spike on and the other one on. So I'm trying to hobble down and like sliding and then it's a mess. And then one of the brothers who's there, who is not like the strongest of us, but he grabbed my spike and he's cold as hell too. And we're all trying to get to the top because that's the end of this suffering. And he just sits down with me, takes off his gloves, helps me put on my ice spikes and like gives me a hug. And like, it was Humble the Poet. And I'll never forget that moment. It's like, I learned something about that man. Like at that point, when I needed something, you know,
beautiful.
He was there and he took off his gloves and he didn't just like, here's your spike and keep on going. No, he like sat with me and he was like, all right,
I got you to completion.
Yeah. He like wrote it out to the end. And so that was an initiation that allowed us to trust each other, jumping off the icy waterfall into the water and seeing how long we could stay underneath the water as we broke through the ice and all of these crazy things that we did. you learn something about yourself and you learn something about the brothers who are there. And sisters, you know, we didn't have sisters at that time, the place, but it was, it was beautiful. And that's what we do in the sweat lodges that we do, in the plant medicine ceremonies. You learn about yourself and you also learn about the people around you. And that's what develops this type of trust. And without those initiatory practices and intentionally going into them, I don't think we can trust people.
Well, you don't know. That's
you don't know.
You don't know until you get into the fire. That's the, I mean, that's the thing about a lot of most relationships that you have with people is you really don't know who you can trust. So you can have an idea that you think you know who you trust and you're like, yeah, I can trust this guy. And then all of a sudden you get in a spot and you're like, okay, well, I guess I can't trust this guy.
Oh, really?
And then this other guy shows up that you don't really even know. And you're like, you are my new best friend. And you know what? And I don't care that I don't relate to you in any other way. Yeah. And it's like what Gabby said earlier about dealing with having to deal with my, you know, monotony in a monotonous time.
I'm not saying I have to deal with it. It's something I observe.
But you know what, I'm saying? But because you know that the thing when it really, really counts, which you know what? Let's hope maybe we never have to go there. Let's hope that we never get in the situation where you have to rely on the person that you need. But just knowing that they have that gives you a certain ease that is the foundation of real. That's the, I mean, and that's why you have it when you have a partner, because you somewhere along the way, when you spend 28 years with somebody, you're going to get a little, you know, you're going to get a squeeze. It's, but that's when you have friends, I mean, I have friends that, I would say I lost, but I lost friends that that just weren't my friends anymore when I knew I couldn't rely on them. Like, hey, I'm come get me. And they're like, oh yeah, I was going to, but you know, I just didn't think you know, they had 1,000 reasons why. Mm-hmm. And then the guys that you barely know comes flying in there and puts their butt on the line for you. And you're like, you know what? You're my buddy.
Yeah, so for sure. Talking about is like the jet ski little
rescuing people, rescuing people. You know, being picked up in front of a giant wave, getting crashing on a wave. And, you know, when you're riding certain type of surf, we're using jet skis to get us on the wave, but also to rescue us. And so guys willing to put themselves on the line, you know, like that'll come and put their butt on the line for you. And sometimes your friend that is your friend that's your best friend, and all of a sudden you look around and he's nowhere to be found, and then he's over on the side somewhere, and you're like, well, you know, I just didn't want to lose the jet ski, and you're like, lose the jet ski,
So for sure,
and that environment, I mean, we're fortunate that we get the opportunity to have that situation to learn, because then you find out what is the real person? Like, what is that real? What's the real essence? Are they just going to be like, hey, no, I'll take that air, which at the end would be going to be hard for you to get over with over that when you were there and you're like, hey, I needed the air and you just took the air. Cause you know, it's not really a choice. It's not like you want that decision. It's just once you see it, it just changes the way you're capable of looking at your friends. Yeah. It just changes. You can't undo it.
That's true. And you have to hold the possibility of transformation.
You do.
Especially if it's someone you love and care for. You know, it's like and also forgiveness and redemption. That's something that I think also culturally we have a really hard time with, is forgiveness and redemption. And we were talking about this, like people who were, you know, finding out that I might have been wrong about that. You know, and I think there's a lot of people who are finding out, I might have been wrong about some things.
Might have been wrong.
Yeah. And
people don't like to be wrong because it forces change. That's the thing. It's because if you say wrong, then you might have to do something a little different, or you have to change how you look at it. We don't like to be wrong. Like, that's not one of the things that we're like, because it forces responsibility. Hey, you're wrong. So then I'm responsible. So now I have to change, you know.
But how about all of our friends who maybe in the last few years have made different choices, and then maybe more information came out and they were like, wow, maybe we've been duped.
Yeah, some amazing.
Sure.
We've had some
and
amazing.
And I see some of my friends and I'm like, man, you're seriously a badass.
Seriously. Yeah,
totally.
Seriously.
And that's so you're holding and you're not shame. You're not holding them in shame. You're not freezing them. No. You're not freezing them
holding
in their moment
them.
Of ignorance. You're not freezing them in their moment of weakness. There's all
you're
there's
cheering them on.
Point. There's
you're
always
like,
point.
Yeah, there's yeah, hope because exactly. you're hoping maybe you can do it. Maybe yeah. you don't even know if do I have the capability of actually doing it? Because that's cool, because that's what it looks like. And I think that's important for all of us is to see these things so we can, it gives us, I mean, we're the monkey see, monkey do, right? That's what we do. That's, I mean, if you can be the monkey that doesn't see and does, then that's congratulations. But normally we, when we have examples of, oh, that's what it looks like to just, and it seems like pretty uneventful. Like, hey, you know what? I guess I was wrong about that. That's kind of, I mean, bummer. And these are big commitments. It's not like you can undo certain things you've done, even though things change and you admit you're wrong. You don't not do it. You still did it.
Yeah.
But at least, I mean, it's nice to see that because it gives, I don't know, like I said, it gives you something to look at as an example.
Sure,
like that's what it looks like to be wrong and to admit and to make a change.
And that's what it looks like for their community to not freeze them in their moment of weakness and not freeze them in their moment of where they fall.
Exactly.
And to say like, no, I'm holding the possibility for the best version of you to emerge.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to keep looking at that version until that version looks back at me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a beautiful gift that you can give to your friends and your lovers.
It's true. It's true.
I always like the messiness of being human. You know, I think, you know, I just feel that the more we can say, hey, I am going to do the best I can and I'm going to show up in the ways that feel really important and I'm super flawed and messy.
Yeah.
It's
well,
so
the admittance
much
of that is
easier.
So beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's so much easier to just work from that place. And I know just from having kids, because like you just told a story about your dad, my kids are like, and I have girls, they're even a little more heavy, I think, because the level that they pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the grace that I get from them because I'm willing to.
Grace is the right word.
Well, that's what they're giving me.
It's the right word.
You know, I always say, listen, whether your kid's 3 or 17 or whatever, you're going to have to apologize.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I thought this. I said we were going to do that. Oh, I ran out of time. I blew it. It goes far. It goes really far. My youngest daughter said to me, she goes, you have a harder time apologizing than even I do. And I'm like, you're right. Because I know
you're
it's,
right. I'm sorry.
I know it's futile.
Yeah.
But it's liberating. It's so liberating to be like, or I thought this, I think this. And also when you're,
isn't
you know,
that the irony though, in a way?
What?
That's the ironic thing. That's how liberating it is when you're able to admit
yeah,
the thing,
totally.
But
you're
then
free.
People won't do it. And so you're like, oh my gosh, you're chained by your,
oh, and they
you're
let
chained
you,
by
they,
your, that you won't just say, hey, you know what? Like I was wrong or I'm sorry.
Exactly.
I was.
It shows a kind of fragility.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like if you're adaptable and elastic, then you're not fragile. Like the bamboo tree is one of the strongest trees because it just bends over when the hurricane comes. And when the hurricane's over, it snaps right back.
Yeah.
Oak, everybody's like, oh, oak tree. Well, there's strong enough wind, the thing will crack, it'll fall. And maybe if it's strong enough, it's just the no wind can come. I am the tree that no wind could come and knock me down. You know, I have respect, respect to that type of tree.
We'll
but
see.
Also, the adaptable
ones. One termite eats one little hole and then.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Laird was always better. Again, I've learned a lot, not only being this relationship, but being with having a family, because it's like learn or die, right? And he's always good, easy, like apologizing.
Well, that's just because I make so many mistakes.
No.
You better be good at apologizing.
No, but I learned.
You got a lot of practice.
I do.
No, but
professional.
But
I'm just good at it.
But I actually.
Oh, I'm wrong again.
Professional apologizer.
He said to me, why am I the one always apologizing? And I'd be like, huh, well. But no.
Because you're always wrong?
No, I never said that. I never said
that. You
thought
that. It.
I did. I totally thought
you
that.
You thought but it,
I never said it.
Yeah.
I think what I learned is as a kid growing up, I didn't have a safe environment to apologize. And I didn't trust the adults in my life. So I held on to this fortification because imagine if you could make a mistake and apologize and then the people around you taught you that it wouldn't be brought up again. You wouldn't be held against you. They would say, hey, I really appreciate it. And then you'd move on. You'd flex that muscle more.
Yeah.
So I had to wait till I was an adult to just, and then I just, I'm like, okay, now when I see, it's like, I even say that if you have a, let's say a difference of opinion, and just for math's sake, we'll do it this way. I'm 90% right in this conversation with Laird, let's say. But what I have learned is even within that 10%,
sure,
he has a really good point.
Mm-hmm.
You should be able to say, yeah, I see
own 100% of your 10%.
I see your point.
Yeah.
It's not hard. I get what your point is. And that's the thing we try to teach our girls. I always say to my girls, like, listen, you might have a thing with me, like a point, but if you could communicate to me clearly, because the problem is, it's like we get into these things with people and now we're apologizing for the way that we approach them with this feeling that we have versus saying, hey, when you did this, it made me feel like that. Can we talk about it? And then they have the chance to say, oh, let me look at it. But if you go ballistic and you go after them and you go crazy, all of a sudden you're like, hey, I'm really sorry that I reacted that way. And you lost your,
yeah,
chance.
Your chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I try to tell them, like, hey, listen, come at us, but try to do it in a way that you get your chance.
I'm telling them, come at us a little less. She said, come at us. I'm going, how about just a little less? Okay.
Just, like, the, can it's we just more the volume.
Just, can we just tone
it's
it down?
It's just a volume.
Oh, they're tough. They're tough. And but so I think there's all those things where once we learn, but it goes back to the other thing you were saying is when I have those people around me that I can trust, then I do feel that vulnerability. And for people listening, we're using sport and nature activity as an analogy for building this resilience. But it could be like you're in the parking lot and someone frustrates you. There's another opportunity right in that moment. We have opportunities small and large all the time to exercise this restraint and the discipline to be stronger to handle.
Yeah.
And so I don't want people to think it's only like you have to train and be like rah all the time. Yes, it is helpful. It definitely helps the organism, but it is reminding them, like, you have opportunities to be vulnerable.
You have opportunities to train every day.
Every day. Someone goes, all right, and you just go, hey, have a good day. Or someone's sitting there and you go, hey, good afternoon. How are you today? You didn't want to. You're shy. You're scared. Whatever. All these small opportunities to make the organism just a little more dialed up.
I want to touch on one of the points that was in there. And, you know, my wife, Vailana, she grew up in an environment where there were irrational levels of punishment for minute mistakes. Like, she got grounded for a year one time for listening to music that she wasn't supposed to be listening to. A year. Well, so,
what, secular music or something?
I don't know. It was like Nappy Roots or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Like, it was like...
Like a Christian home or something?
No. Oh. That's the thing. It was like, it was a very strange scenario, but
discipline,
nonetheless, like an overreaction, right? There's an overreaction to the action. And in the overreaction to the action, then she learned, like, all right, well, in this environment, I'm going to lie. I'm going to fucking lie. Because if I get caught doing the smallest thing, the reaction is so great that I'm gonna learn. So she's had to, you know, go through her own transformation of relearning that pattern, which requires, like, no, it's okay. You, like, you fucked up, you made a mistake. It's okay.
Yeah.
Like, you're not gonna be grounded for a year. Yeah. You know, like, this is not the—
You're not in survival mode.
You're not in survival mode. And I think that's, you know, I don't have kids yet, but I intend to. And and in that, I think one of the reasons why, you know, I feel very blessed by my parenting is that it wasn't a punishment household. It was it was based on the bond of love. Like, and they would, so if I did something, then they would express to me how it hurt them or how it hurt another person. So they always just showed me the pain that it caused and then allowed me to trusted my own compassion, my own actual sympathy, you know, for what I did. And then I would feel so bad. And then I would learn, but they never had to, they never had to discipline me.
Yeah. Because they spanking would have been easier.
Yeah, for sure. Than really looking at everything you did.
Spanking, like, okay, whatever.
I'll get a tougher ass.
I'm done. Okay,
I'll get a tougher ass.
What's next?
No, but I think what you're saying is a really important point because, you know, I use this analogy a few times. I've had times where I was playing a game and I'd have a coach that would look at me in a way that was like, no, you're going to figure it out. but I didn't know I was going to figure it out. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I could do it. And they'd say, yeah, you'll get it. And just that, I would either get there sooner or I would go back into the situation with, all right, I'm going to figure it out. And I think with our girls, we talk about not creating good liars. We talk about yeah. that a lot.
Yep.
And by the way, girls would be way better liars than boys. They just are. No, we're
more transparent.
We're way more thoughtful and think, sure. well, if I do this and they say that. And yeah, of course.
I like the way you say thoughtful attuned. And I say manipulative.
Okay, you know.
Emotionally attuned. Let's just.
Yeah, just we're more, that way we're certainly more deathly. But that sometimes we talk about with our girls, if they're going through a hard time, it's that just even thinking they will work it out. They're going to get there. That vibration, I think they feel it versus you don't say anything, but they think, oh, they don't believe in me.
Right.
And I think as a parent.
And also giving them the comfort to be able to express themselves and not be, when they do, you don't just punish them for that. So mm-hmm. giving them that platform where they feel yeah. that they can kind of just talk about things to you in an open way, which at times you're kind of going, you know, like, did you have to tell me that? But you want that relationship to be open like that so that they have that. So then they, because they want to tell you. They actually want to tell
you. It's the craziest thing if you like you're telling your kids like they can't have sex. Well, all right, you know, fine. But what if they do? And then what if there's an issue? And what if there's something? What if they really need to talk to somebody about it?
Can you imagine?
You know, like that's a nightmare scenario that doesn't work. Like closing off the conversation about sex or recreational drugs or any of these different things, it
takes away the interest part of it.
Yeah,
the truth is, when you communicate with them open like that, they're less
way more conservative.
They're way more conservative. Right, they're way more. Then they're like,
because you can also share the truth of the perspective, and they can actually talk to you. And so if they come up upon that situation, or if they even fall down in that situation, like I took this pill, or I did this thing, or and it didn't work out well, and you're like, it's all right, let's I'm here for you. So that's one aspect of it. Another one that came to mind was what you're saying about like, I trust you guys to work it out. Like I'm imagining a fight between the girls, you know, and I'm imagining a scenario where you go,
right,
I hear both of you, but instead of you declaring and being the judge and like, I declare you're right, I declare you're wrong, you go, you're punished, you're not, like, I trust you guys to work it out.
Yeah, as long as when they're younger and one was a lot bigger than the other, it was like, please don't kill your sister.
Of course. Of course. That's when you have to step in.
That's when the physical part is like, now you're...
I'll give you an example. We have our youngest daughter does like to stir the pot. That's her personality. It's fantastic. I'm sure it's going to work out really great for her in her life. But our middle daughter is in a relationship with an incredible guy and they're great. But my younger will go in and poke them both. And before you know it, they've almost ganged up on the youngest, right? And I have been in a situation because I'm the mom and you do have these impulses where I want to like always do a little sister and sister should get along and all this. And then my thought was actually, no, this guy is only interested in my middle daughter, all her needs and protecting her and what's right for her. And then I thought, oh, you know what? If in my lifetime, my daughters could each have a person like that for themselves.
Right.
That feels really important.
Oh yeah.
And plus my youngest daughter is a troublemaker. Right. So I was like, well, you kind of created it.
It's some part of the real consequences of the psychodynamics of being in family.
Right. And then the other part was like, I was so happy for my middle daughter that I was like, she has this person who likes us fine. It was very nice to the younger one if she wants to be cool, but is perfectly happy to stand on the side of his partner. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's what you want for them.
Yeah.
Someone for them, not someone who's like, oh, hi, Mr. and Mrs. Hamilton. No. You're for her.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
and I think the biggest, I know that for us sometimes, at least I'll speak for myself, but just having to stand on the sideline sometimes and not interject, not try to thing and just kind of let them, you know, I think it happens early on. So it's like a muscle, you know, you get trained at it. Like when you see your daughter crawling over the thing towards the staircase and there's like a stair and she's going to fall down and you're kind of like, you want to go grab her, but you're kind of like, oh man, I really don't, but I got to let her kind of fall on that step so that she understands the consequence of the step. And so it's a little bit that, so I think for us, sometimes that's been at least.
Athletics definitely helped with that.
Well, I think about, I've been sharing a lot of family stories here, but it's, I think about my stepbrothers, Brian and Tom. And Brian and Tom would always get in fights. But, and I was about the same age difference to Brian as Brian was to Tom, right? So you could assume that, you know, Brian's a fighter and he was a fighter. So me and Brian would get in fights, but we never got in fights because we competed against each other. We competed at fucking everything, everything. Like whether it was, you know, late at the house and pool, we're playing pool, we're playing basketball, we're playing yard football, we're playing whatever. Like we got to actually compete, and Brian and Tom never competed. They never compete. Tom wasn't an athlete in that way, but Tom had a idea about being a fighter and a man. And Brian was like a rascal. He's the youngest of the boys, and he would poke and then it would turn into a fight. But it just also, you know, it reminds me, this conversation is just reminding me of that dynamic where, what, well, how come me and Brian never got in a fight? And I'm just realizing it's because we were always
competing,
play fighting.
Yeah.
You know, constantly.
With rules.
Yeah. And so we got to get that out.
Yeah.
You know, so if we were like, if we felt something, it'd be like, let's go out on the fucking court.
Yeah.
You know, let's see. Yeah. Let's see.
Like a gentleman's battle.
Yeah, exactly. It's
beautiful, like what Yuki's doing in Chicago, just like where they're bringing.
Our friend Joe Kim Noah has been taking guys from different gangs and they play basketball against each other.
Inner city stuff.
And it's really creating a different flow and harmony between the guys.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. They get to play against each other and that's, they've had some big success.
Plus, I think we ultimately always respect a worthy opponent.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, Bird and Magic may not have loved each other, but like, they fucking respected each other.
That's right. You know, it's so beautiful.
It's a very important thing.
And I bet now they could probably sit down and have a few laughs and really appreciate
sure.
it, right?
For
so,
sure.
So at the end, part of their of that whole friction allows them to actually probably have an understanding of one another that's beyond anybody that they actually know.
Yeah.
Probably the two of them could relate to each other and understand each other better than even players that played with them on their own team.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that.
Yeah.
Are you hopeful for the future?
I am. Yeah. I can get lost in periods of despair and despondence. But when that happens, my whole system powers down and I'm not alive anyways. So I make the conscious choice to continually step into the brave winds of hope and like dare to hope and believe and see the more beautiful world emerging.
Yeah.
And, you know, is it going to happen? I don't know. But I'm going to see it and I'm going to believe it and I'm going to be the last one to get off the ship of humanity. You know, if we're sinking, I'm going to be the last one to say like, keep bailing, keep going. And I'll be the last one that dives off the ship of humanity and life. And I really believe that about myself. You know, I've found myself deeply and I know that that's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a choice to just keep hope alive even when things seem hopeless. And I don't think we're anywhere near a place where I think things are hopeless because also I have, you know, I have a gnosis of God, of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'll never count the divine out. Like I'll never count God out. Like God's got to play. And I think there's rules to the game and there's free will and there's, you know, the game of life has its defined rules and God's not going to do something crazy and just come in and there's a voice in the sky and he's going to sort it all out for us. Like, right. But in us, as us and through us, as the divine working in its subtle, miraculous ways, I think there's something that the algorithms can't predict. And there's something that we will never see coming that's going to be emergent because of the divine working in us, as us and through us.
Absolutely.
And that's what gives me hope. That's the only thing that gives me hope. Because if you look anywhere else, we're headed towards a disaster. But if you really believe, if you believe that there is a force that binds us all together, this life, source, universe, God, whatever you want to say, like if you really believe in that, you're always gonna know there's a chance.
Yeah, I feel that way. And I, Laird, in our house, though, we always say, though, pay attention.
Yeah, because the pathway, we don't know what the pathway will be. We don't know how bad it will get. We don't know what we're going to have to endure. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know what the challenges will be. And I think that's why you have to build these internal strengths and characteristics. You know, a lot of people are focused on the external. Well, I got 7 years of beef jerky and I got, you know, 5,000 pounds of rice and I got enough ammunition to last me, you know. Okay, great. But how's your internal constitution? Like, yeah. How much are you investing in yourself? And also, how much are you living right now? So if it becomes that hoka, hey, today is a good day to die moment where a wave is coming and you can't escape it and you know it's death, like, can you look at your lovers and the ones in your family and the ones you love and say, like, I love you so much and I fucking lived and we lived and we did the best we could, you know? Like I want to live. I want to live that hokahei life. I want to live a life where no matter what, no matter if tomorrow it's the end and you know, we get the signal that Russian nukes are coming and we're launching our own. And I want to know, like, you know what, Aubrey, like, fuck it. You fucking lived. And there's nothing you can do right now, but you lived. Lived. And so it's...
That's our job. If there's anything we're supposed to do, it's that.
Yeah.
We're supposed to do that.
It's true.
Ride the wave.
Ride the wave. You know, if you're going to go out, if there's a huge wave coming.
Yeah, go out in flames.
If there's a huge wave coming.
No, it's true.
Go the layered route. Strap that fucker in and let's go.
No, it's true.
Remember when we had that fake bomb one on Kauai? Yeah. Did you hear about that a couple years ago? So we were sitting in Kauai and our girls were sleeping downstairs and we were drinking coffee. It was really early in the morning and Laird's like, well, there's a, you know, this bomb, whatever, missile. Right? And I was like, okay, we're having coffee. And he was sort of like, would you do anything different right now? And I'm like, not really. We're all here.
Let's go up on the porch and enjoy our coffee
and go
on
look
the
at
porch
the view
and not crawl into a drain somewhere.
Bay.
Yeah.
And, you know, and be scared and then come out to a place you don't want to be anyway. It's like, because it's not going to be too nice if there is one coming and the thing's leveled.
That's right.
And that means setting your affairs in order. You know, people have in near-death experiences, you have a life review. That's the blessing of a near-death experience. And I would say that, you know, the plant medicine path that I've taken has brought me to many of those life review moments. My very first one was this massive life review moment. And so I've gotten the blessing of being able to look at my life many times from a point where it seems like obliteration is imminent, at least the obliteration of the self that I knew. And really all I really care about is, like, did I do my best? Did I live the most I could? Did I move with courage instead of fear? All of these things. And if I lived that way and if I squeezed the juice and tasted the food and made love like a, you know, like a warrior poet, like if I did all that, like, all right. So the life of Aubrey Marcus was 42 years and 8 months. Okay, so be it. You know what I mean?
Seriously.
Like, no, so seriously. Be it. Because we've lived. And there's a peace in living every day like that, and that no matter what happens, like, you know, you've lived.
Well, and it's a little bit like when we talk about the training or competing, when you leave it all on the court or the field or in the gym or whatever, it's good.
No regrets. I said to somebody this morning, I go, we're talking about, you know, passing on. And I go, when I get up there, I'm going to be like, what do you think? How was that wave riding? Was that good? Did I live it? Was that sufficient for a life? Like, I rode those big waves. Is that, I think that's our, you know, I think intuitively sense in ourselves. No, we do know that, right? We know if we're living a life and if we're not. Like, I think we're given some of that skill. Yeah. Like, I think that's one of our, you know, our intuitions, our sense, like we can, you know, like we can sense truth if as long as we have the truth, you know, the truth sword sharp, we can sense it. You can, you know, I told somebody that it's almost like looking, you know, they talk about wanting to, the truth. And I go, well, if you, it's kind of like hunting. If you hunt for an animal, you start to know its characteristics. Right. You start to know its footprints. You start to know its behavior. You start to know where it likes to go. Pretty soon you're like, well, where is it? It's over there. And that's acting like this. And that looks like it. And that, yeah, that's the animal. So I think there's something to be said about that.
I think truth has a resonant frequency. So like if you've lived a world where you have, imagine that, you know, you've never heard real music and all music is offbeat and off tune and it's untuned. You've never had real music. And then are you going to be able to tell if the violin's out of tune or if the guitar's out? No, because you've never heard it tuned.
Right.
But going up against the ocean, being in the ocean, that's real music. That's God's music. Going up in competition, that's real music. That's God's music. Like that, like that's real. And so it gives you a way to actually know, like, oh, I know the feeling of truth. I know what authenticity and honesty really feels like. And it reverberates in my body. Anthro, ontologically, which is anthropos, the body, ontologically, that which is real. Like, you know it. It's like we're all actually tuning instruments for the truth. But the problem is if you've been bombarded with reality shows that aren't real and news that's not
you
honest, and you know, yeah, everything is all manufactured and packaged and manipulated, you may lose your bearings to like your ability to resonate with the truth. Mm. Like you may not be able to detect, like, yeah, is that a true frequency?
No, that would definitely block your signal, right? Being, yeah, not having the ability.
Sure.
Yeah, just not being identifying, not having experience with it would definitely make it hard.
Well, we got a wild ride ahead of us, and
we're getting our sleep and training and we'll be there standing.
And also, I think it's important to be aware of the sea, like when you're going to navigate, like when you're in a boat and you're going to navigate somewhere, kind of important to know
where you're going
and what's out there. Like
what's
what way is the wind blowing? What way is it potentially going to blow? Like it, cause sometimes I find myself spending time looking at a lot of stuff that doesn't seem to be making sense for me to spend time doing it. Like to know, what do I need to know about this and this and this and all this stuff? But somewhere intuitively, I feel like I need to know it. I need to know it just to help me, mm-hmm, navigate the terrain, you know, navigate, sure, the environment, whether that's identify people that the you know, that are doing good things, the people that aren't doing good things, like you know, so you have at least you have some way to, some bearing, some kind of, mm-hmm, some knowledge about the potential of where you're, yeah, going to go, because you're not going to just arrive at a place without, you know, having some right, idea, like how we get there.
I want to ask like one question that's coming to mind is like, you talked about sharks and sometimes there's going to be a shark bite. Something's just going to come out of the deep and it's just going to hit you. And there's a part of me that wants to believe, like, if you're listening to the ocean and you can feel the subtle vibrations, you'll actually feel like maybe today's not the right day to swim in this spot. Maybe today's not, something's off. And I do believe that. I do believe that's
I have it. I felt it. I done it. I know. I've been in the water and thought, I better go in. I don't like it. And then later I'll hear, oh, did you hear that they saw a giant shark? And I go, yeah, because I felt it. Like I knew it was there.
Yeah,
so
we,
if we're in harmony, I told somebody, it's like this, you're walking through the forest and you just kind of go, something over there and I can't see it.
Right.
And there's going to be a big old grizzly around the corner that you, I mean, we have those skills, right? We have those ability, those intuitions, those sensors that give us the ability to know that stuff. Now we've become so, distance from that because, yeah, we've killed everything dangerous and we've made everything, you know, we've gotten rid of so many of the things that we needed that for. But though that's something that we're built with, we have that ability to sense those. I mean, I think because of my relationship with the ocean and the time I've been in it, I'm more hyper sensitive in that specifically in that,
sure,
environment, and maybe the level of fear I have of, you know, being eaten by a giant animal with huge teeth, but you know, like you're like, okay, sure, cool. But having that feeling like, you know what, something doesn't feel right. And reacting off of those, I've talked before about, you know, you'd be walking down a street and you look over and you see a guy on a ladder and something's weird and you just look and the leg of the ladder is, there's a little hole or something. And you think, well, if that guy keeps doing that, that thing's going to go and that guy's going to fall off the ladder. And you don't think any of it, you just walk back by. And then later on you hear, oh yeah, the guy on the ladder down the street just fell off and died or whatever. And you're like, so the next time you see that, you go, you know what? Hey, you know what? Yeah, if you keep doing that, and then you keep doing that, and every time you feel that, those intuitions, you react on them. Mm-hmm. That's that muscle, that intuitive muscle gets stronger, and you get better and better at seeing it and reading it because it is an instrument that you can tune. Like you can become more. I mean, women have a natural, women's intuition. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a reason why they don't call it a man's intuition. It's called a woman's intuition, where they, like, Gabby will warn me, you know, she'll just be like, hey, you know what, just be careful today. Like I had a thing and I'm like, and I go into high alert. Like, okay, she warned me.
Yeah.
Let me be conscious of what's happening. Those are real things. Like we really have those, you know, superpowers. Those are, I mean, they're a lot duller than they probably were in our past, because we're so far away from nature where that's where we had it. It's like, why do animals, you know, go to the mountains 2 days before the tidal wave? Like all the animals just vacate. They're like, oh, we don't know. All the animals just ran away. Like, how'd they know? They don't have Geiger counter. They didn't know it was going to be an earthquake, but they intuitively, the relationship that they have, they're still in their essence in with nature. And so they react that way. And I think we can reawaken ours and be more.
Yeah, our connection to the field.
There's no doubt.
And then still, there's going to be things that, you know, you can't explain in a random. You know, I was there at the New York Jets, you know, September 11 game with my best friend, Aaron Rodgers, you know, and he's never been more excited about playing a season. He's never loved a team more. He's like, he was so all in, you know, spent 3 days there before and he's getting ready. And then he's out there and fourth play of the game, you know, it goes down. And like, there's so many thoughts that you could have about like, oh man, should I have felt this in the field? Like, could I have warned him? Could I have like, could he have felt this in the field? Is there something that he wasn't looking at? Mm-hmm. But then you have to also make space for just, there's chaos and chance. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have bodies colliding into each other on a turf field, there's gonna sometimes be something weird that happens. So ultimately, you know, I drove him home from the game in the third quarter. They brought me down because he couldn't drive because his fucking Achilles is ruptured. And so, you know, I'm talking to him and I'm like, I don't know why this happened. I don't know if this is God's plan secretly to have some mission and influenced it that way. I don't know if dark forces in the universe came in and shark bit you. You know, I don't know. And I don't know if this is just chaos, man. Yeah. But what I do know is it could be any one of those or some combination of all of the above. But what I do know is you get to decide what this means to you. Yeah. And you get to decide and look back. It's your choice whether you look back at this and say, I'm grateful for that or I'm not. And that depends on the actions that you take. And that's the only thing that you can do in those situations where the shark bite comes.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever been not grateful for any of the injuries I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's why I'm sitting right now, right here.
Yeah.
So not one of the things that's ever of my in my life ever. I mean, at the time I didn't love it, and during the process I didn't love it. But maybe what I learned through the recovery, what my training was, what my diet was, what my just whatever saved me from being in another situation where I might have really perished and not just been wounded, or whatever the million things are. I just think that those are all. That's part of where that we have to have that kind of faith. You got to have that belief that. In the system, you have to have that belief in the system. That's when you're talking about believing that, you know, it's going to be okay. Well, that's connected to that.
Yeah.
It's all connected to that, right? It's connected can do it again, you know, and all that process of the failure and what you learn in that, you know, in that injury kind of, because injury is failure, right? When we look at injury, it's just another I lost, mm-hmm. right? If you're hurt, you're lost. It's the same thing, right? So, mm-hmm. but that process of losing or being hurt and then coming back around and being able to do it again,
yep.
right? That is where the transformation happens. That's the, yep. you know, that's
it's
it.
The most romantic story you can live is the living most. The story. It's not romantic if there's not hardships no. for the hero.
Yeah.
You know, like if it's like easy for the hero, hero's sure. like, ew, this is fucking
yeah,
easy,
yeah.
you know?
Exactly.
It's not romantic.
Exactly.
It's what makes big wave surfing romantic is yeah. that sometimes it goes terribly wrong. And that's the romance. Yeah. That's the romance of the yeah. thing, yeah. you know? And that's the romance of competition too, is yeah. sometimes it's fucking really hard and things are brutal and you're really down and you have to dig fucking deep and just say, no, 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 I'm going to assert my will into this field and I'm gonna come out and there's yeah. something emergent that's going to be there. And that's, life is fucking romantic and we're living in romantic times. And if we can look at that, it's like, this is the times where we get to the opportunity to be heroes because it's romantic as fuck.
And crazy entertaining.
yeah. yeah.
I mean, when you watch the humans, you're like, oh my God, look what they're doing now. Like, what were they talking about? The aliens looking down going, yeah. Somebody goes, oh yeah, aliens wouldn't care about what we're doing. I go, are you kidding? Like, have you seen what we're doing?
it's,
like, this is some entertaining
incredibly
stuff.
Interesting.
I just watched like one story and it's entertaining on TV. Never mind just watching the whole group. Look at the whole group, what we're doing. It's like, oh my God, now what they're doing? What are they doing now? No, come on, are you serious?
Come on, humans, really?
You gotta be serious.
Oh, man, I didn't see that one coming.
I'll tell you
Snap
really
out
a
of
quick
it.
Tale to sum up what you just said. Larry came home and, you know, unlike Aaron or, you know, a basketball player, Laird surfs with everybody. So mm-hmm. if on smaller days.
You know, right.
So he'll go out and surf and I guess he fell or something. And he came in and he said, yeah, I was out surfing and I fell on a wave or something. And some guy comes up to him and he goes, I saw you fall. And Laird goes, you saw me fall? and the guy's like, yeah. And Laird's like, I've fallen on more waves than you've ridden. And I thought, that's about right. But everyone, yep. like people see, oh, the moment, but they don't realize how many wipeouts there are.
Of course.
For real. It's like Aaron's there. That's how he got hurt.
Yeah.
I'm playing.
Yeah.
I'm in a position to get hurt.
18 like, years.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Exactly. Like the fact that you're even there says it all. It's like.
He seems like he's in a good place though. I feel like.
Yeah. He'll bounce
he'll
back.
He'll rally back.
He'll bounce back.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got the warrior poet in him.
Yeah.
That's why he's my best friend. Yeah.
I could see that.
Well, we send our love to him too. I was not happy when I saw that.
I know. It was tough. Mm. Well, this has been such a great surprise and delight. We didn't know this podcast was going to come together.
I know.
Until like
when they called me and they go, we're going to go. I was like, there's no way those guys are available. So thank you.
Of course. We were supposed to come the day before, which you
to
wouldn't
you,
be in
right.
the whole thing.
Thank so you, it, though, to you yeah. and to your crew yeah. for making room
yeah.
for us and making it happen.
Yeah. Of course. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you for sharing the poetry and the tears and the
yeah.
love.
Way to start the conversation.
Hope. Yeah. Yeah.
And, no, you know, no. I know we could go down a lot of holes, but.
Yeah. Yeah,
we'll leave it at that.
Maybe we'll do another show.
I want to do a show with you once after you've had a kid.
Yeah,
I can't wait. It's yeah. You'll be like, you know, that stuff I thought, well, some of it, no, I'm not sure.
For sure,
I'm just kidding.
Sure.
I'm kidding.
That's
we'll
the guru.
About tempering your soul.
Yeah,
in the words of Byron Katie, the two best things you could ever do as a parent for your children. Listen without fixing their issues. Just listen. Hmm. Truly listen. And make yourself happy, whatever that
Show
means.
Show them what happiness looks
so
like.
So they yeah. know what it looks like.
That. Well, I think I got the second part because I can show them how to live
I'll
a life
you a
that's
trick.
Really happy.
This is like a steering wheel, a make-believe steering wheel. And when they're in the car, this is obviously like a young tweener or teenager. Uh-huh. You just kind of squeeze it. Just squeeze it.
just squeeze it.
And like, oh, okay. Don't say anything. Just squeeze the steering wheel. It's really good.
Well, yeah. I'll leave you with, so I believe that parenting is like building a samurai sword.
Mm-hmm.
So your children, they take you, they heat you up, they beat you with a hammer, and they stick you in a bucket of ice. And they do that over and over. And again, at the end, you're a tempered soul. And so I think parenting is our highest evolution of evolving as a human.
If that's your choice.
Yeah.
Because I also always honor that people maybe are teaching from a different place.
Yeah. But when you're in the parenting mode, let's just say when you've
been made subjected that choice, to, you know. You've had a uncontrollable biological urge. I saw Larry and I never thought about kids. And I was like, oh, I would like to have his babies. And I was like,
Yeah, totally. Totally. That makes sense. Well, because also there's a field of trust. It's like, this is going to produce something. There's a father here that I can trust. And so my biology is like, let's do this.
Yeah.
There's a woman and I will supply her with all the meat she needs.
Thank you, lover.
Anything you guys want to, you know, share with the listeners? Anything you guys got going, just projects or?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, we just always want to invite people to take care of themselves. That's what we always hope. Yeah. The invitation. That's all, just the invitation. And as far as projects, we have, you mentioned it earlier. Thank you, Laird Superfood. I have a podcast, The Gabby Reese Show.
That one's
very
hot.
Original. And Laird is the guy out in the ocean.
I'm on Marcus' podcast. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Let's go.
So I can remember. and then Laird will be the guy out in the ocean looking, you know, for waves.
I got plans, but.
He's trustworthy that way. Thank you for having us.
Yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thanks, y'all, for listening. We love you. See you next week.
Aloha.
Thanks for tuning into this podcast with Gabby and Laird. It was recorded before all kinds of crazy shit started happening in the world. So blessings to everybody listening to this at this time and this place. Sending infinite love to all of you.